Recording in progress.
Recording in progress.
That Zoom voice is such a slut. I'll tell you what's in progress, Zoom, this podcast. Michael, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm excited. We have a special episode. We'll get into it in a bit. But how am I?
Yeah.
I'm fine. I'm considering different storm window options. You know, I'm doing that.
Oh, well, fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
Good thing we brought, you know, we're talking about storm windows in the Talmud today, right? No, unfortunately.
I don't feel like I have, I got nothing. I got nothing, Hava. I'm an empty husk.
Great. That's the way you want to start an episode.
How are you, though? How are you?
Baruch Hashem. I'm well. I'm chilling. I pruned the tops of my houseplants today to make them come in more bushy. So I'm feeling great about that. I ate a slice of pizza and a clementine. What else is going on? Read a sugya from the Jerusalem Talmud about the students of Hillel killing the students of Shammai, which I hadn't read before, or vice versa.
Right. Again.
Shammai students killing Hillel students. Tomato, tomato. You know, some students killed some other students. It was wild. That was my surprising text I encountered this week. And yeah, I'm excited. Our guest's energy has already gotten me in a very salacious and vivacious mood. So I think we should just cut to guest. All of you, hi, how are you listeners out there? Welcome to the show, Rafael Nice. Rafael Nice is a scholar and artist who is a professor of history and Judaic studies at the University of Michigan. Their art has been featured in various publications, including The Huckleberry Notice, which hosts their comics column, Those Rabbis. Rafe is currently at work on a book called The Talmud, a graphic novel. Other book-length projects include a Jewish bestiary entitled A Pictorial Field Guide to Queer Jewish Creatures and Why, a trans book series for children, and finally, a non-binary history of ancient Judaism. Rafe, welcome to the show. Hi, how are you?
Thank you so much, the both of you. I am doing pretty well, thanks to some chocolate.
Oh, what kind of chocolate is that?
This is Flake, and I grew up with it in Northwest London. And I don't know if they make it in the Americas, but, yeah. You know, my youngest sibling brought it with them when they came to visit for Kratzmuch, as a Kratzmuch present. And so right. I thought, what better to sweeten this conversation than super saturated sugary chocolate?
Right. Well, thank God. I mean, thank this God. Conversation, you know, needed sweetening. And you have brought to us conversation about your book, When a Human Gives Birth to a Raven, Rabbis and the Reproduction of Species. What's up with that book? What's that book about?
Right?
Every time I like tell people, like, I'm so excited, I'm going to have this person on the show. They wrote this book called When a Human Gives Birth to a Raven. And they look at me like, what is that?
Are you for real?
Yeah.
Right. So I'm glad that the book title achieved that's the correct response. Like, what's up with that? And then, of course, the following, you know, rabbis and the, reproduction of species. So what's up with it? So the title, I'll say, is almost directly taken from a line of Mishnah, which is Hamapelet Kemin Dmut Orev, one who aborts or expels something like a raven likeness. But you can sort of see I've updated a little bit. I've taken away the fem grammatical ending and I've replaced it with a generic species marker. So instead of she who aborts a human woman who aborts a raven, it's now just a human who gives birth to a raven. And right. The rabbis and the reproduction of species is kind of cheekily alluding to Darwin's reproduction of species. Because, you know, I think the rabbis were cheeky and grandiose. And so the book is something about the radical unpredictability of reproduction in antiquity, something that we don't think about at all. So it's a little bit in your face. And then it's associating that world in which, a human can sometimes, as we know, give birth to a raven, maybe a camel at other times, who's to say? And that world is the world in which the rabbis lived. So the book is something, the title is to sort of hopefully pull you in and make you wonder about what it means to live in such a world.
Right. I hadn't really thought about this until this moment, but in the introduction to your book, you talk about sort of two challenging projects that the book takes on, one of which is sort of exploring the strangeness and familiarity of the world of antiquity, and two is making our own world more strange to ourselves. And I feel like the book title really accomplishes that just by being as confusing as it is.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's question mark.
It's okay. A compliment. We adore mystification and confusing ourselves.
Oh, totally. That's what it's all about.
You folks read the Talmud, so clearly.
Right. We're clearly open to that kind of play. So yeah. What drew you to this topic of the mysteries of rabbinic ideas about reproduction?
So, you know, actually kind of, as is often the case, I find when reading Talmud or Mishnah, you're just reading, you're plodding along. You're reading the tractate of Nidah as one does, right?
Yes.
And it's,
yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
And you're like, this is both weird and boring, which is, I think, again, the sign of being a Talmud nerd of some kind, the tolerance for both. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I'm reading blah, 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 bloodstains, blah, blah, blah. Of course, that's the technical Hebrew right. language. Blah, 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 red, yellow, this and that. Is it menstrual blood? Is it just, you know, some other kind of secretion? The Tractate of Nidah, listeners, is a tractate that governs excretions that people with uteri seem to emit and thinks of.
Of course, I challenge that. It's specifically about uterine.
I know. Yes. That. Yes. Although actually contemporary biomedicine also challenges that. Right? Right. Like you don't have to be born with a uterus to have various kinds of secretions. And I love your right. challenge. I accept your challenge.
Great. That can be an appendix to this episode.
It can be. I like that. So, and I mean that in a literal sense now, in the sort of having right. ones. Yeah. Okay. Bad right. puns. Oof.
Right. Human Ooh. Gives birth to an appendix.
Oh, yes. Well, actually, having witnessed a human give birth to a placenta. Oh, my God.
Oh,
what,
yeah.
What
I've
the
never
actual
witnessed a human placenta birth, but I've witnessed a lot of animal placentae.
Yes. Aren't they? Anyway, they look like ghosts when you lift them up. They
yeah,
kind
they're
of
so voluminous.
Yeah. I'm glad we got off on this because the rabbis also. get off in, of course, the entirely respectable
yeah.
sense, just mm-hmm. to be clear, listeners, dear
Absolutely.
Listeners. So in the third chapter, suddenly the rabbis move from what we might call menstrual secretions to more solid things that might be emitted and they list a bunch of things like somebody who emits a batch of red flies, somebody who emits a bunch of fish and scorpions, somebody who emits something like a kind of species of domesticated animal, and let's not forget wild animal, and of course, let's not forget the bird, and so on and so forth. And they're trying to understand and pass these, I should say, gory materials, right, if we take it really mm-hmm. seriously, and that are they menstrual secretions, which means that the person in question is in a state of ritual impurity, et cetera, and eventually, if they want to have sex with a spouse, they, you know, they need to ritually ablute in the mikveh, a ritual bath. And at some point, it seems that the sort of entities that are being emitted are scanned for their potential as births, as offspring, as deliveries. And I'm reading this and I'm like, oh my God, it suddenly dawns on me that I need to break the habit, the modern Western rationalizing habit that I have of seeing this as metaphorical. That when the rabbis say, kamin chaya, literally like the kind, like the species of wild animal, this is taxonomical. This is sort of like the rabbi's zoological language. And they are describing a case of a trans species birth. And then I just perseverated in a kind of, you know, along with my ADHD, I just kept reading it over and over. I drew my spouse in who, and I just want to be clear, this is an utter coincidence. They happen to be an OB-gynecologist. So they're an obstetric.
Wow.
It's a complete coincidence. And I'm like, what do you think about this? And they're like, showing me horrible pictures from this terrible textbook called Williams Gynecology and Obstetrics. And I'm like, I wish you hadn't shown me that. Thank you very much. And then I come across another tractate, which is the tractate Bechorot, which governs, among other things, the obligation to sacrifice certain firstborn animals to God in the temple. And that lo and behold, you have cows giving birth to camels, donkeys giving birth to horses, and vice versa. And instead of asking, is this offspring, is this menses, they're asking, is it worthy, is it fitting to be an animal sacrifice? Or even more importantly, can I eat it? Right?
Yeah.
Is it Kosh?
Right.
And I'm like, wow, there's something going on here. There's a radical instability to reproduction. And as I read more in ancient medicine and anthropology and ethnography, it became clear that this is the world that ancient people lived in. And that brought me to investigate what is the world of creatures? Like, what is the zoological, ecological world in which ancient people lived, Jews among them? And also, how did they understand reproduction to happen? And it, of course, that turned out to be even weirder. So that was sort of the journey, perseverating over two little bits of chapters in two tractates of the Mishnah.
Wow.
That's the answer I'm telling today.
Yes. I'm so glad you did perseverate over it, because it has inspired me. The Teshuva Writing Collective, Zman is working on a series of Teshuvot about Brewer Vu. So reproduction is in the air. So it has been a very inspiring read for me. Michael, do you have anything you want to say before I babble on?
There's so many things. Yeah, I think the way that Hava and I have generally approached reading these like crazy, what we would call hypothetical situations, is to treat them as these are just bros trying to one-up each other. But you're kind of saying that, like, no, we have to actually maybe acknowledge that they are thinking of this not just as like an intellectual sizing up competition, always like a fun game. They're actually working out how they think the world works. And I was wondering if you could talk about that in comparison to the redactors of Tanakh, you know, if we believe in that as something that was written down by humans. Like, what's the difference between how you see the rabbis conceiving of these reproductive and animal categories versus how, like, Tanakh sees it?
Oh, wow. What a great question. And maybe I'm kind of going to first go to the bros kind of being daft, and then kind of go to the kind of the differences that I'm seeing between Hebrew, especially Chumash, especially Pentateuchal authors versus the rabbis. I definitely, I'm offering a different approach. I'm sort of saying that sometimes when there's no question that there's, especially in the Bavli, that there is a way that you can see that they're playing with what statisticians call permutations and combinations. You know, when they like take this whole thing and then they kind of do it again, but they add one more ingredient. It's like differential equations or something. And, you know, you're like, you have to reconstruct the whole previous sugya. Every time you pick it up, you have to, well, at least I need to relearn it because they've just changed that one ingredient. And you're like, this is really familiar. Did I just read this on the previous page? And you're like, yes, but for this one thing. So there's no question, I think, that in the Bavli, there is something about the genre that is playful and proliferative in that way, that can temper our ability to say this is how they really thought. I think that that's not the case for every single kind of scenario. And I think that in certain situations, especially when you see something that is reflected across culture at the time, so other folks in the ancient world, doctors, philosophers, what you might call anachronistically scientists, so really philosophers, are writing about this phenomenon. And that there's a way sometimes the thing that makes us say, oh, this is ridiculous, is because of modernist lenses. To us, it's ridiculous. I find that as a historian, I think that the trick is to let go. For me, in my work, is to try to let go as much as I can of that rationalist modern lens that, you know, will sort of disregard certain things as absurd or superstitious or wrong, and approach it as, what does it mean to live in a world where things like this happen? Because it's also the same world where people meet God dressed in white. It's the same world in which demons maybe accost them in the loo, the privy, the bathroom, just like, you know, getting more refined as I, it's a world in which the dead speak. So in that sense, it's to kind of submit a little bit to a world that is weird. And then, so I don't know if that's, I think it's a different approach. And we get different things out of doing it. And I can answer your other question if you like. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, do you think in some ways the pre-destruction of the Second Temple world was like less weird to the Jews who had intellectual authority back then?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that the problem is that it's always a problem, of course, of whose voices we're getting, right? I mean, you know, we're always getting a slice of a kind of a slightly distorted, partial slice of what people thought. But definitely in the pre-rabbinic sort of, or like pre-destruction of temple, angels, demons were very alive for people. Like if you look at the hymns in the Dead Sea Scrolls, a lot of those hymns are imagining that the congregants in Qumran are praying together or entering the hosts of angels. And if we imagine for a minute the weirdness of what a temple would have been like, a cacophony of stinky barbecued meat, blood escaping the kind of carefully dug blood aqueducts that were around, jostling of people trying to sell you. Yes, yes, exactly. Like, you know, people in just these outfits with bells attached to them, kind of fabulous outfits that were like, you know, taking a nice hefty cut of the meat. There's nothing straightforward and ordinary about that world. Yeah, so I'm not sure that, I think it's just sort of different weirdness, if that makes sense. And the rabbis are also living in a world in Palestine where there's a bunch of gods around. They're encountering lots of different cultures and traditions, Greek, Roman, you know, other ethnicities that are living in the Galilee and in Judea. So there's also, I think, the landscape in which the rabbis are living is jostling with weirdness. But yeah, I didn't answer your question about the Bible and animals, but that will probably come in at some other point.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it'll bubble up. I have a million different directions that I want to go, all of which are like completely different from one another. One of the things I was thinking about is, you know, we encounter so many stories in Talmud and in Tanakh where non-human entities have all kinds of different personalities that we don't usually associate with them. I'm thinking especially of a story we did an episode on of Reb Nachman's daughters being accused of witchcraft for stirring the pot with their hand. And, part of their whole rescue story is that a raven flies by and issues a prophecy. And the subject of the prophecy says, that is a lying raven, so I'm not going to listen to it. And there's this whole potential like etymological connection with the root of the word raven being kind of fundamentally transgressive. And all of that is sort of a unnecessarily elaborate way of asking, like, what do these trans-species interactions sort of tell us or tell you about the different way that the rabbis related to non-human species and their sentience or their experience, their place in the world relative to us?
Yeah, no, that's, first of all, an indirect and elaborate way of asking a question is always the preferable. A question that is in part an answer is really the only way to go. So one of the things I find is that there's definitely a genre difference between, say, what you might find in Tanaitic sources like the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Sifra, and the Sifrei, and then later Midrashic and kind of Talmudic sources, where you'll have, I find, in my experience, much more of that delightful, sort of more dialogical, interactive narrative, those features that you're talking about, which I really, and actually when I wrote the book, I wanted to do more of that. And of course, you know, I was like 300 pages in and I'm like, I've barely touched the Yerushalmi, never mind the Bavli. So just to say, yeah, but like there isn't one answer, obviously, but there is this, I'm thinking of this source in, I'm trying to remember, it's in, well, there's a lot of amazing stuff in Chulin, right? Which is, of course, the tractate on, I guess, non-temple slaughter. I mean, it's just amazing zoology in Bavli Chulin. But what you also have is something that's a bit like this sort of the raven stuff, where you have this person who's also spoken about actually quite a bit in Vayikra Rabbah, where there's some very cool like what I call like nature observation sections, where these rabbis are like experimenting, sometimes quite abusively, with non-human beings. There's this dude called Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, who decides that he wants to check a verse from Proverbs that describes the ant as particularly enterprising and somebody who sort of collects food in the summer in time for the winter.
And he, similar to how the cat is modest.
Exactly. And so he goes, though, and he decides that he's going to go and observe. So and he wants to check if scripture is right, which is also just such an interesting way of doing natural science. And he goes during a very hot month, the month of Tammuz, and he takes his robe and he puts it over an anthill. And then one ant comes out. And I'm thinking of this as almost like a weird form of rabbinic experimentation. He marks the ant, which I'm like, how is he even doing that? Yeah. I find that this is where I find being really literal is fun. It's like, I'm like, okay, what did he do that with? And that ant, so he can like observe, he's got like patient zero or whatever.
Right.
So this is what I love. The narrative of the Talmud just casually explains that ant, so the ant actually has a voice. You know, so it's like, do you do the layering thing when you study Talmud, you know, to see kind of break down the sugya, to see who's, you can kind of just do the stump, you know, you locate the stump, you locate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you could also include the ant actually has dialogue in this sugya, which is kind of wild. So the ant says to the other ants, oh no, it's shady outside. And so all the ants are like, okay, it's safe. So they all go out. And then Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta takes away his robe and they get completely scorched by the sun. So they go and they kill this ant. So Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta is doing this social experiment, but he's observing.
Right. He's doing his Stanford prison experiment on the ants.
Basically. And the narrative just very casually and neutrally reports I don't even know like the adjective, but ant dialogue. And then, you know, Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta just wants to sort of figure out, does this mean that they have a king? Because if they'd had a king, then they would have had a sort of a justice process. They would have had to have gotten permission from the king. Right. And it becomes a whole sort of there's a kind of cruelty to it. But I guess what I see in it is, and I don't argue that the rabbis are radical eco-feminists, who are in favor of a kind of interspecies collective dependency, right? But what I do argue is that there is an awareness that is not just human-centric, that non-humans have sociality, have community, and that is partly born by observation, right? Because they are observing, they are in that sense not so different from Aristotle, who went around observing animal life. They're just doing it for different reasons. So in this story, right, the rabbinic scientist, and they give Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta an interesting name, Askan Bidvarim, someone who's like busy with stuff, right? And he's, yeah, he's like a, you know, what is that? A scientist, an experimenter, an interferer.
Right.
All of the
a
above.
Busybody.
A busybody. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, he's driven by the need to, he takes scripture really seriously. And when scripture talks about ants, it means, and the scripture, the actual passage in question says, it's something like, go and look at the ant, lazy person. And he's like, that's an instruction. And he goes and looks at the natural world. So he reads the text, that the biblical text becomes a way, a lens, a research question, if you will, for the natural environment. For Aristotle, he wanted to understand how animals worked, right? It's a very different outcome. But, and this sort of goes to your question, Michael, earlier, people have often not taken the rabbis seriously when we do the history of ancient science. It's like, oh, the rabbis didn't do science. They mentioned stuff and they were wrong about it and they would do it by the by. But we look to Aristotle for science. We look to Galen for medicine. And part of my point is like, no, just because the genre is different and just because the research questions are informed by a religious lens does not mean that this is not knowledge about the natural world. Like, we should bring in this weird perspective into our accounts of the history of ancient science. That's a long-winded answer to a slightly different question than the one that you asked.
No, that's okay.
As it should be.
Yeah, I think you go into this particularly in Sifra, right?
Yes.
So there's religious motivation behind it, but there's incredible detailed taxonomic exploration of animals. Some of it like reflects similar models of how we think about taxonomy now in the animal kingdom, and some of it is vastly different and strange and related to like location of the animals and things like that.
Yeah, and first of all, I'm just thank you for reading. I'm so grateful because you know it's sort of like again that willingness to be both bored and weirded out. So thank you.
Our pleasure.
Because, you know, that, oh my God, the Sifra, oh, it's such a, yeah, that is like slightly painful reading. You know, it's like the Sifra, so it's the Tanaim reading Leviticus 11, which is list, Leviticus 11 is already listy, but at least like the lists are relatively short. They have a certain logic, choose the card, etc., split hooves, fins and scales, birds, no logic. nothing, just a list of like things that you can't eat, but then nothing about what you can. And then like the rabbis, as you say, like they have at it and they casually often just insert things that like, for example, so those of us who read Talmud know that the rabbis take it for granted that there's behema, domesticated, let's call it animal or quadruped, classically, cows, oxen, sheep, right?
Classically beautiful animals.
Yes, exactly.
Good eyelashes. Pigs. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Statuesque.
Pigs don't have eyelashes, though, unfortunately.
Really?
I don't know. Do they? I actually don't know that.
I was just, okay.
Okay.
Big sidetrack. I was just on a phone call earlier talking with two other people that I have the joy of doing Talmud with about whether if you're a furry, you're allowed to dress up as a non-kosher animal.
Go on.
Your furry activities if you're a Jew. And if we take furries at their word, that their fursona is a reflection of what they are inside, can a person whose fursona is non-kosher be a Jew?
Oh, I
to
love
which
this.
I replied, there's no halacha that says a pig can't be a Jew. So I just wanted to bring that energy into the room.
Oh, this is us. So perfect because, of course, the Yerushalmi asks a woman, gives birth to a raven. The raven flies to the top of the palm tree, as ravens are wont to do.
Like
we all know this. Oh dear, the raven's brother dies. So the question is, do you say to the raven, come, marry your sister-in-law, because they didn't have any children, or do you say, come, let us slaughter you and eat you for dinner? And so it's not completely far away from the question that you're just asking, because ravens actually are not kosher. I feel like it's important to mention that. They also pose the same scenario with a behema and presumably a kosher behema. But they actually do ask this question. What I love is that like in that scenario, the person is like, oh, okay, I'll come and be dinner. And they even have the person learning, like studying the Torah. So I think that the rabbis do ask this question. I don't know if you folks have read Le Chat du Rabbin, The Rabbi's Cat. It's really, there's also like an animated film that in my opinion isn't as good as the, anyway,
it is cute.
It's, I still like it. So the first volume, which I think they only translated two volumes into English, there's this moment where the cat swallows a talking parrot and can suddenly speak. And then the cat actually wants to study Talmud. Right. And the rabbi is like, I don't know. And then the cat wants a bar mitzvah. And then the rabbi is like, exactly this question. Well, I don't know if you're like, are you even Jewish? And then they go to the rabbi's rabbi, who basically says, this is ridiculous. Everybody knows that humans are made in God's image. And then the cat's like, well, how do you know God doesn't look like a cat? And then the rabbi's rabbi is like, drown the cat. Which is like, so it's sort of like bringing, it sort of brings, I guess, both in that scenario and in the rabbi scenario and thinking with the fursona, one of the things that brings, okay, maybe not so much with the fursona, but with those two scenarios, what it brings to the fore is how what some trans and black sort of study scholars call killability, like whose bodies, when does animality actually make a certain body more killable, or removing a person's species assignment as human do a kind of violence, right? So in some cultural moments, to be animal is to embrace and to play, right? Like you can think in terms of furries. But in other cultural circumstances, when it's not consensual, or when other people are animalizing you, that is a way of justifying killing. So not to get like dark about it, you know, but there is that, there's always that play. And yeah, I don't think it's, I'm not sure how I kind of ended up in that direction from.
It makes sense to me that the rabbis would be curious about the place of animals in the world, because one of the ways that I think about the rabbis project is they're sort of dreaming up the world that they would like to live in, both in the post-temple period slash they're sort of envisioning like what the future of Judaism, what would they like the future Jewish society to be? And they sort of pretend that that's the way it already is sometimes, but also what will the world to come be, because it will be sort of an embodiment of this halachic dream. And they must have seen in Tanakh that like non-humans were clearly very involved in that world, either as sacrifices or otherwise. And so that needed to be a part of their process of figuring out what the world they wanted to be was, figuring out how, what role would animals play in that world. So it all fits together into this big piece of figuring out the place of Jews, figuring out the place of people, figuring out the place of animals. It all fits together.
And then they're like, oh, the Leviathan. On the one hand, God plays with a Leviathan. That's actually God's, I mean, God is maybe a furry. Like God's like, and I don't, it doesn't say what kind of play. It could be there's like a really cool divine dungeon. Like, who's to say, right? But then also the Leviathan is the delicious reward of the righteous.
Much like the phoenix. The chaste, passive-aggressive phoenix.
Yes.
It seems like the rabbis kind of are doing it both ways. They're being a little furry-y in the sense that they aren't being negative all the time about these interspecies relationships. They're at least neutral and curious. And then other times they are being negative. And what was I going to ask?
Like when you say interspecies, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was wondering if there's like these kind of positive or at least neutral kind of humans are at the same level as other animals, or at least might have weird, you know, equal relationships. They talk about women a lot, you know, giving birth, Nida, that kind of stuff. Are there examples where the men are the ones who like are also kind of on like, par with animals? That it would kind of almost support the idea that it's a positive characteristic, that there's this gray area going on.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think you're right, there is this play of seeing the human as one species among any, an animal in a certain sense, and then the urge to human supremacy, for sure. And one of the things that I really love is the way that they trip themselves up I feel like almost unconsciously, that once humans start to see themselves as animals, it's harder to gain the mastery. But the rabbinic, and I use the word advisedly, you know, with its complex history, like on the one hand, the rabbinic project is to tame to tame the world under the rabbinic kind of system of categories. But it's, you know, when they try to do that, then they have to admit that humans are bipedal, and that if they're bipedal, well, it turns out that actually, and this is actually really cool, it turns out that their blood and flesh may be kosher, which is not something we really think of. And once they put the human inside the system of kashrut, the system in a way unfolds a little bit. It cannibalizes itself literally, because the human is the person that has knowledge, that creates zoology. It's a quintessentially human field. We don't know how animals organize knowledge of their world. But the minute the human admits that they too are animal, and that they lactate, that they bleed, that they urinate, that they defecate, then these are things that are both gendered and not gendered, right? They're speciesed as much as they're gendered. And they do this in the Sifra. Then they start to acknowledge as well that the humans, like other animals, have doubles. So one thing that the rabbis understand is that there's a rule in the world that everything has a double. So in the city, the creatures that are in the city have doubles in the forest and in the desert, in, you know, unhuman occupied lands, what we today call national parks. And everything in dry land has a double in the sea, except for one or two cases. And then they have to kind of, to make their, once you've tamed all knowledge like that, you end up again inserting yourself in the picture. So this is what I mean, that the presumption, the chutzpah of being in the image of God and declaring the names of the animals like Adam does in Genesis 2 eventually comes full circle, because Adam isn't just a proper name. Adam is a kind. Adam is a min. And so then the rabbis confront sirens, maybe mermaids, or they confront, and it's interestingly gendered. The sirene is gendered, is like a femme kind of human. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, and then there's the Adneha Sader, the sort of feral human that seems to be maybe more masky. I'm not sure. But then you kind of, their system falters a little bit, right? Because what does it mean to recognize that it's not actually, there isn't a cleavage between the human and the non-human. There are these para-human entities that are a bit of both. And that, by the way, I guess I was also sort of thinking about, as you were asking this question, or as you were talking about like interspecies relations, I thought maybe you were going to talk about sex and Kilayim as well.
Oh, I would never talk about sex.
Well, podcast? I know, it's a little bit outrageous. But like sex between species, because that's one of the ways that some beings relate, you know, some just mm-hmm. do engage in parallel play. And, you know, and sort of I was sort of wondering, you know, because for me, that kind of the way that hybridity, like, you know, bringing two kinds together in sex and in work is a biblical prohibition. So I don't know if that's something that you were going to you folks wanted to talk about, because.
Well, I am going to instead steer
yes,
us because we've
I love
been recording
it.
For 47 minutes and we haven't said the word gay that whole time.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it. Let's make up for it.
Yeah. So gay shit.
Yeah.
So you draw a connection between the relationship of queer and trans people to reproduction and this whole journey exploring the reproduction of species. Can you say a little bit about the connection between those two themes?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, where do I begin? So one thing that has been leveled against, I'm going to like do some queer and transplaining because, you know, there's not enough of it in the world. There needs to be so much more. You know, one of the many claims and cudgels that is used to try to stop queer and trans people from being is the idea that they don't reproduce or they don't reproduce properly. That on the one hand, the future of this human species is at risk. That queer and trans people are animal-like in just having sex for pleasure and not for reproductive sake. But on the other hand, queer and trans people reproduce in the wrong way. They're groomers.
Right.
And by that—
We don't reproduce, we recruit.
We recruit. And, you know, they don't mean, you know, really kind of that we wash and brush the hair of dogs and tie bows in them. But,
although
you know,
many of us do.
Many of us do that and are thinking of opening a service. And we wonder, is it too soon to say transsexual groomers?
Right. It's not.
It's never too soon. So there's something at foot. There's something about reproduction and queer and trans people that is presented as a kind of clash. And then you also have like queer and trans people kind of refusing, let's say, homonormativity and what Lee Edelman calls reproductive futurity, that everything mm-hmm. has to be geared towards the children. But what about the children? Right. Which is a path towards respectability. So there is this apparent tension. And so one of the things I'm really interested in doing is showing that reproduction for the rabbis is, especially human reproduction, is queer. It is not monogamous. It involves at least three parties. Now, a couple of those parties might be a man and a woman, but God is involved in reproduction. And it's not a metaphor. It's not a metaphor. It involves actual physical faculties of animacy and sight and voice and cognition. And each party, in admittedly problematic, hierarchical, sexist ways, don't get me wrong, right, contribute to different facet of the human being. So the human is, in fact, a product of kilayim, the very forbidden kind of coupling. It's not even a product of coupling. It's a product of tripling, which I love. So there's that aspect to it. And then there's the sort of gay aspect of, again, like non-monogamy is, I think, a big part. Non-monogamous sexual reproduction is a big part of reproduction in that is understood across antiquity, that humans and animals don't just proliferate through sex, that there are other ways that you can be part of reproduction, not just metaphorically. So the classic example is whether you want to see Rabbi Yochanan, and this is sort of where the gay trans stuff comes in, as trans femme, or, you know, for obvious reasons, I'm like, well, maybe trans femme, but also and or non-binary, and I don't use it in a transcestory kind of way. I hold those terms very lightly, but it's very clear that the rabbis understand that you can be party to reproduction outside of the family structure, that you can enter into a reproductive relationship with at least two people. And we see that also borne out outside the Talmud. So I look at a bunch of the magic bowls, which, of course, describe the fabulous Lilith, who I also argue is not exactly a woman and not exactly a man. I mean, they're a demon, so they're not exactly human, but their gender is iconographically, it doesn't quite fit a binary iconographic scheme according to the pictorial conventions of that time and place, so that they are very kind of gender queer in their presentation. But one thing that you see in those magic bowls is a bunch of women divorcing Lilith. And generally speaking, in rabbinic ritual arrangements, women don't initiate divorce. They do not write contracts of divorce. They do not issue writs of divorce. But in these magic bowls, you have women, often married women, who are divorcing Lilith. And I guess here's where the gay comes in. We just hear from those marriages, those poly marriages, from the ones that went bad. And I like to ask, what about all the marriages with Lilith? You know, and
happily married to their non-binary demon wife.
Exactly. Exactly.
All of you listeners out there, I'm sure.
Yes, exactly. I mean, how are you and your spouse, you know, doing with Lilith? Right. You know, is it, where are you in your triples therapy journey? Right.
Reading your book was the first time it really helped me to rethink, you know, we talked about Rabbi Yochanan all the time on the show. And I've taught quite a few classes on Bava Metzia 83 Gay. As we like to say in the community, which has the story of Rabbi Yochanan sitting at the entrance of the bathhouse so that people will have sex to have little Yochanan babies. Mm-hmm. And reading your book was the first time I realized, you know, you get that formula to see the gleam of Rabbi Yochanan's beauty. And the formula starts out in the sugya by saying anyone who wants, asks, requires, or needs to see the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan. And I've often wondered about that verb, like, why does someone need that? And reading your book was the first time I conceptualized that it is a fertility recipe. You know, you need that gleam so that you too can have a little trans Yochanan baby of your own.
Yes. Yes.
You can see that gleam in your own time and place.
Yes. It's like beautiful. Clearly a children's book that needs to be written.
My Yochanan baby.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a recipe. It's a ritual mechanism for a queer piriya or rivya.
I do not know that term.
Sorry. I apologize. Yeah, it's the nominal version of peru revu is, I just, it might be my English, English accent. So it's like a peru revu is, of course, the imperative. Reproduce. Reproduce, multiply. Piriya or revia. Fructification. It sounds rude, but it's just, using the fruit. I really like literal translations. Fructification and multiplication. So it's like a means to, here's how you do it at home. Yes, here's how you can have transsexual babies.
Right. Thank God someone out there is telling us the parenting tips we really need to know.
Correct.
Have also been thinking about, you know, there's been this trend. I mean, thankfully, this trend has died down a little bit now. But in the past decade or so, there was this huge trend of writing, you know, hot take think pieces about the six genders of the Talmud that we've all blessedly sort of let that period go. But I was thinking about how those six genders, you know, Saris, Tumtum, et cetera, they do sort of have this reproductive categorization to them,
yes.
that they all have something to do with what your relationship to reproduction can be, which is kind of a funny way to think about, you know, I've just as I'm talking about letting go of them as genders, they're sort of just genders that happen pre-reproduction instead of post-reproduction. You know, we assign genders as you're born, but
yes,
are genders that are sort of taking place based on your relationship to the other side of the reproductive process.
Nice. I mean, nice, but also not so nice.
Not ideal.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, Rabbi Yochanan, of course, famously, this is me, I'm always very literal. So like famously carries the bones of like dead children in his pocket.
Right, right.
You know, yeah. So like, you know, there's like at least some tradition that has Rabbi Yochanan, that has them being very proliferative. And that's a very literalizing thing. And yeah, I think that actually that kind of reproductive, that relationship of gender and reproduction is a very limited perspective. I'm very curious, of course, like about what you're doing on the Peru or Revu front, trans-wise.
I'll announce here on this episode that my personal teshuva is going to be about whether trans women who contribute genetic material transmit their Jewish status with that genetic material.
Right.
To whatever children may come of it. Which a lot of sources will inform that. One of which, for instance, will be there's a drash in Talmud, I forget the citation exactly, about how Goliath was the child of 100 fathers, potentially 100 fathers and one dog. And just that complication of the reproductive process, I think, is sort of one of the gateways for introducing the idea of more than two or three even people involved in the reproductive process that I hope will be instrumental to that argument. But that's my, still have a year of work to do on that.
So. Oh, great. I mean, the dog, of course, is so interesting.
Yeah.
Like the species thing and the accusation. I mean, I guess that reminds me also of the way that reproduction and bestiality are used to work against queer folks, right? Mm-hmm. Like that somehow there's just this weird positioning of queer sex in relationship to animality and reproduction. Mm-hmm. And so that it does seem to sort of come together. And that's where, you know, Michael, when you mentioned the sort of interspecies thing, the tendency in scholarship and sort of right wing, particularly Christian thinking, to compare homosexuality to bestiality, but also to kilayim, right, to interspecies sex. Because, of course, bestiality is marked. But it's just one example of interspecies sex. It's really interesting that we have a special word for when humans have sex with other animals, but when other animals have sex with other animals, like, what is that, right? Like, well, that's okay, because they're all animal. But like the tendency in scholarship to want to see kilayim, the forbidden kind of sex between, well, human-engineered sex between animals, as something deeply immoral just isn't there. I guess this sort of goes to your tshuva. Like, the rabbis are super pragmatic about it. Like, use it as much as you... Like, they find ways to incorporate the product of supposedly forbidden couplings or triplings or quadruplings into the fold. You know, I mean, they're, like, perfectly happy. Well, maybe a little ambivalent about mules, right? Because maybe, you know, because mules are also... in a way, creatures of, you know, that allow, you know, they're creatures of empire. They're in a way a very Roman kind of animal that allows the exploitation and importation of resources from Palestine to Rome and vice. And, you know, it also brings armies their food. So there's some ambivalence about
mules.
I'm
going to have to really reconsider mules. I'm doing a whole episode series on foxes now. So mules is going to have to be next.
I love that. That's considered a normal sentence. That's so great. I'm really going to have to reconsider mules. Everything I've thought about mules.
I mean, and now, of course, I'm thinking about like Mary riding into Jerusalem on a donkey.
Yes. I often think about that. It's just a practice, a spiritual practice of mine.
Right. I'm just gonna... Funnily enough.
It was Palm Sunday like pretty recently.
Literally
too.
Today, oh. Someone had to remind me that Easter exists.
Yeah,
someone Easter like exists. Canceled something because of the holiday this weekend, and I was like, "What? Do they? They're Canadian." I was like, "Do they have a special Canadian holiday this weekend?" Like, no, you fool. Easter exists.
Yeah, it's so confusing. When is it? Like this
Sunday? Right?
Wait. And today's today's what is it?
Good Friday.
Thank you.
Friday?
Thank you.
A Friday of some quality.
Yes, that is not neutral.
Of a different color. Anyway, I've interrupted you enough times, Michael. You'll probably get the last question as we spiral towards our conclusion.
So you mentioned that the rabbis, they're trying to categorize the world around them, and in doing so, they sort of see the limits of categorization in general, and it starts cannibalizing itself, and they run into all sorts of problems. And, you know, these people, they're pretty smart. They must be aware that they keep on running into this problem. I mean, your book focuses on animals, but if you go deep into like any area of halakha, you run into this inevitable, like, we just really don't know what the hell's going on kind of conclusion. And mm-hmm. I kind of wonder if they are doing this on purpose. Is this like a way, is kind of getting into this weird, it's almost like doing a lot of drugs or something and being like, we don't know anything. Oh my God. Like we're all
it's so deep.
It's so deep. We're tripping. We don't know anything. Wow. 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 Is it right, you think, to contrast that with like the temple cult where maybe things felt more, perhaps were they more like the boundaries felt more stable? Are the rabbis trying to deal with the trauma of like the destruction of the second temple, and like the reaction to that is kind of this like almost like hippie? I mean, it's not hippie, but it's maybe
yeah,
a similar psychological state of mind that, you know, a disenchanted middle class person in the 60s might have towards their country that would make them become a hippie.
Yeah.
Is there a meta reason why the rabbis are doing this, you think?
Okay, that's such a great question. Wow. So I think it depends. It depends. The end. Yeah, as quickly as possible. It depends when, you know, who we're talking about. So for example, the later strata in the Pentateuch, say the priestly strata, which we associate with people who ran the temple, you know, scholastic priests who were like invested in the temple, many centuries before the rabbis, let's say in the 6th and 5th century before the Common Era, they're the ones who are like putting that first chapter of Genesis in, where everything is super ordered, and we see the word minim, species, right? And they're the ones who are doing all that stuff in Leviticus of sorting out the taxonomy of nature. They're also figuring out the sacrificial system, right? It's very clear, to me at least, that that world is not a world that starts to bite its own tail.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. That is a kind of a much more harmonistic, it's not exhaustive. It doesn't claim to be exhaustive. It just gives you the chapter headings of things, right? Like the way the Sifra goes into that is such a wonderful, like you pointed to that contrast, Michael, because the rabbis are like, and this, and this, and this, and also creatures that are born in fire, and also creatures that are born in water, you know, and it's just like, by the time that Leviticus 11 is left, it's just in shreds and tatters, and it's just populated with all kinds of, it's just like an unholy mess. And the holiness system of the priests, I think, doesn't, it's less crowded, it's more harmonistic, it's much more hierarchical. But I don't know that that translates onto the entire history of the temple until the first century it was destroyed. So that's where I would say, I think that's what I mean by it depends. I think that it's sort of, you know, if you look, for example, at later sources like, you know, the various books of the Maccabees, you've got chaos and imperialism and, you know, fighting. So it just sort of, it's very clear that if you think about the history of the Second Temple period towards the end of that period, it seems like you have a Jewish monarchy, you have the Hasmoneans who are expanding Judea and just converting people to Jews. That is not the Second Temple of order. So I want to just remind us that the Second Temple period is a very complex period. Having said that, there is something, and this brings me maybe sort of full circle to the bros, you know, they're just being, they're kind of just, there may be something, while I wouldn't necessarily say that, especially the Palestinian rabbis, the Tanaim and the Palestinian Amaraim are kind of like trying to see who can get more ridiculous. There may be something in that project of trying to regain control of the world that is about being in the shadow of empire, like being living under Roman control. There may be something that is, there may be a political aspect to that project. And I see the failure as potentially two things. One, the world has agency, whether it's animals or bodies or menstrual secretions or business relationships or oxen that gore. The world is, in some sense, always has unpredictability, excess, animacy that is beyond the rabbinic capacity to imagine all the scenarios. So that is that aliveness of that ancient world is in the texts. It's the rabbi's project of mastery is really more of an attempt. And I like to imagine that the ancient world is pushing back. Like that's the tension that we see. That's why the project is not, it's just a quest. It's not necessarily ever fully resolved. And that's, I also see that as potentially a rebuke to Roman projects, which are similar. Like there's this dude Pliny who's doing the natural history and he's dedicating it to the Roman emperor, where the project of science is very much about Roman conquest over the goods of the world. And so I sort of see what the rabbis are doing as a kind of resistant form of science that resists the mastery that the Romans are trying to enact through violence.
That makes sense. So instead of bros trying to one-up each other, it's bros trying to one-up the universe and waiting for the universe to give another move to it.
In a way, and that perhaps the rabbis are, they're in a less powerful position. They cannot, in the same way, you know, command the world with the threat of death, the way that the knowledge, the people who are creating knowledge in the Roman Empire are partly sponsored by imperial might.
It feels very connected to the oh my God, what's that book called? It's by Sergei Dolgopolsky. It's about how the rabbis aren't philosophers, they're rhetoricians.
Yes.
Anyway, mm-hmm. It just feels kind of the tension between philosophy as a totalizing system.
Yes, exactly.
Versus rhetoric as a system of effect and affect.
Yes. Yes. That's a great analogy. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Sergei. Anyway, what a marvelous episode this has been, and what a delight it's been to
Likewise.
Have you on the show. Do you want to promo something to our listeners? Where can they find you? Where can they keep up with all of the magic that you're
putting
into the world?
Oh, darling, thank you. I guess they can look at my website, which is www.rachelrafaelnice.com. But even more pertinent is my handle on the Insta, which is postraphaelite. very cheesy.
Incredible.
Yeah. And there they can keep up with zines and such. And at some point I'm going to be doing a sort of virtual book launch / fundraiser for the Ruth Ellis Center, which is a center for LGBT folks in Detroit. And so keep your eyes peeled for when that drops.
Marvelous. We will
thank you
to all of those things.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah. To all our listeners, Shavua Tov.
Shavua Tov.
Shavua Tov.
There's this song I grew up kind of very from. Uh-huh. And there was this song that I learned in a summer camp called Benot. It was called Benois. Benois. And this was the song. How are you? How are you? How are you? How are you? Fine. Baruch Hashem. So every time I think of Chai, how are you? I'm like, I've got all the Beis Yaakov girls.
Oh my God.
Anyway, I thought it'd be really cute to raise the little 2-year-old to sing that song.
Yeah.
And so I have.
Wow.
The
Incredible.
End. Yeah. I feel like I should that be the end of the recording, perhaps?
Yeah. Episode over.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Sure. Yeah.